Sie hören eine Aufnahme des Kepler Salon Linz vom 2. November 2011 zum Thema Resources Without Borders, Remittances, Linkages and Ties with Home among Zimbabwean Migrants in the SADC Region. Zu Gast ist Tracer Galvin, Department of Sociology at the University of Botswana. Gastgeberin ist Petra Eigner, Institut für Soziologie an der Johannes Kepler Universität Linz.
Okay, I would like to say hello to everybody. Thanks for coming to the audience. To introduce myself, I'm a lecturer in the University of Linz at the moment. I lecture on migration studies and in the Department of Theoretical Sociology. Most people here I know. I'd like to introduce Dr. Tracer Galvin, who is a former colleague of mine from Trinity College Dublin. She now is a senior lecturer in the University of Botswana, and we're very happy to have her here. She will talk about resources without borders, remittances, linkages, and ties with home among Zimbabwean migrants in the SADC region. Tracer was born in Waterford, studied in Cork, and then the University of Zimbabwe. And she is based mainly in the field of migration studies. Her areas of interest are anthropology, sociology, migration studies, kinship, family structures, and then migration systems in the south of Africa and from Africa to Europe. So she is a real specialist. And her fields of publication are really in the same areas. So I'm pleased to pass on to your talk now, Tracer.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, let me begin by, first of all, thanking Petra, Dr. Eigner, for the invitation and for allowing us to have the opportunity to come together this evening. Do we need this? Can you hear me without it? Oh, okay, that's fine. No. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Okay, no, that's fine. That's no problem. So that's my thank yous done. Let me perhaps begin this talk on remittances in sub-Saharan Africa by introducing you, first of all, to the region. I put this map together just to give you some sense of the region which we're talking about. I mean, this is the African continent, and these countries in red are essentially the countries of SADC. SADC stands for the Southern African Development Community. It consists of 15 countries, three islands, Seychelles, Mauritius, and Madagascar, though there is a hiccup in Madagascar's membership at the moment with their political turmoil, and then all of the countries which you see here from the Democratic Republic of the Congo down to South Africa. I mean, essentially, SADC grew out of what were known as the frontline states. The frontline states at the time in the 1970s and 1980s referred largely to the countries that were bordering the apartheid South Africa system and which were in many ways being destabilized. So it was a grouping of countries, a political grouping of countries aimed initially at simply helping each other to survive the destabilization processes within the region. In 1980, it then formally became the Southern African Development Community. And in many ways, it is a regional grouping, like any regional grouping. Its main aims are to encourage economic and political integration within the region. So it has some overtones of the type of regional grouping we saw at the outset of the European Union. All of the countries in the SADC region have a history of colonialism. And they vary from the countries of Zambia, for example, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Malawi, which were British colonies, countries such as Mozambique and Angola, which were Portuguese colonies, Congo, which was a Belgian colony, and then some German influence in Namibia, and of course South Africa, divided perhaps between a British influence and then the Afrikaner or older Dutch influence. Equally, all of this region has both a historical and contemporary attachment almost to migration. It's very much a reality of the region. All of the countries have signed various international, continental, and regional treaties and protocols and conventions on migration. So, for example, they've signed the 1951 Geneva Convention, the 1969 Protocol, the 1969 Organization of African Unity Convention on Refugees in Africa. And then more recently, we've had the 2005 Protocol within SADC itself. The 2005 Protocol is called the Protocol on the Facilitation of Movement within SADC. What it is, essentially, is an expressed desire or wish within the SADC region to progressively minimize borders and to progressively minimize immigration control. So I suppose you could say that the 2005 Protocol is a type of the concept notions behind it are a sort of free movement of people within the region. Since it was drawn up and signed in 2005, there's been very little progress throughout the region in implementing this protocol or in moving forward with it. Nonetheless, we have significant amounts of migration within the region. And while we do not have very accurate statistics on the levels of migration, we know, just on a day-by-day basis, that there are significant amounts of movement, both across borders in various ways, and also a considerable amount of migration within countries, because migration in Southern Africa is very much international migration, where people cross international borders between countries, but there's also significant amounts of internal, mostly rural-urban, and we also see urban-rural migration, reverse rural-urban migration in many countries. What I'm going to talk to you about this evening is perhaps the largest migration within that region at the moment, which comes from Zimbabwe. And today, I suppose it's fair to say that Zimbabwean migrants over the past decade have migrated to all of the countries within SADC in quite large numbers and much further afield as well, to Europe, to the United States, to Canada, Australia, and so on and so forth. But from what we know of this migration in the past decade, South Africa certainly seems to have the largest number of Zimbabwean migrants. It is notoriously difficult to try to establish what the numbers are, what the statistics are. We've had statistics that range from 4 million Zimbabwean migrants to 2 million to 1 million, and globally, that is. It was thought for quite some time that there were probably 1 to 1.5 million Zimbabwean migrants who had left for Zimbabwe for South Africa over the past decade. But in 2010, just last year, the South African government set about regularizing the status of all non-documented Zimbabwean migrants and took a considerable period of time in which to do it. The total number that were regularized was 285,000. So it was a fraction, in fact, of what even the South African government thought would be the case. It was a very liberal, very, very straightforward process. There were sort of no fear engendered in people in participating in it. It was an amnesty, effectively, to allow people to regularize their status. So after that, towards the end of last year, most people began to say, well, if we double that number, we are probably not looking at more than 600, perhaps 650,000, right? Next to South Africa, the next largest number of Zimbabweans are in Botswana. After that, Swaziland, and then smaller numbers in Malawi, Angola, Namibia, and Mozambique. The pattern which they have tended to follow is very common again within the Southern African region. People initially migrate to countries that have had the same colonial master, as it were, as themselves. So the countries of Zambia, Malawi, Zimbabwe, South Africa all have a common language in English. The countries of Mozambique and Angola have the common language of Portuguese, along with their own vernacular languages. Plus, there are very close ties between people because these borders were very arbitrary and essentially arbitrarily drawn up during the colonial era. There are very close ties between people, across borders within the region. So that gives you some of the background to this migration process. To give you perhaps some more details on the sort of Zimbabwean situation, that there's been a tendency in the past decade, because there has been so much out-migration from Zimbabwe, to assume that migration is somehow a new feature of Zimbabwean society and that it's only really in the last decade or so that people have migrated out of Zimbabwe, or that there's been, you know, a connection between migratory processes in Zimbabwe. And that, in fact, is quite inaccurate. Zimbabwe is one of the countries in the SADC region that has a very long history of migration and a very long history of different patterns and different forms of migration. What has happened is that, of course, over time, the patterns, the types, and the forms of migration change. Looking at the history of Zimbabwe, one finds, first of all, there were migrations into Zimbabwe in pre-colonial times. So before these borders even existed, you had the movement of groups such as the Ndebele population into Zimbabwe from South Africa. The colonial era brought a significant amount of in-migration, though like all the countries in the SADC region, Zimbabwe was a limited, what we call a limited settlement of a colonial population. In other words, a situation whereby the incoming colonial population did not outnumber at any point the indigenous or local population. In fact, they were quite a small percentage of the population. So you had an in-migration of a colonial settler population. You had, during that colonial era, a considerable amount of rural-urban migration, largely labor migration, to service the towns and cities and mining industries and sort of agricultural systems that were growing up. You had a considerable amount of migration from Zimbabwe during the colonial period in this region into South Africa. Again, mostly labor migration to the mining industry in South Africa and some to the agricultural sector there as well. You also had replacement migration, whereby Zimbabweans went to South Africa to work on the mines, but people from Malawi and Zambia and Mozambique came into Zimbabwe to work in the agricultural sector. Because while the industrialization process was stronger in South Africa, the growth of an agricultural economy was the kind of mainstay of what was in the colonial times, southern Rhodesia. In the 1970s, you had, again, considerable movements. You had very large numbers of Zimbabweans in the 1960s and 1970s who left Zimbabwe, basically to get educational and work opportunities abroad that they would not have had or would not be able to acquire or have at home in what was effectively a colony. During the liberation struggle in the 1970s, you had, again, significant movements of people as refugees across the borders, mostly into Mozambique and into Botswana. And then at independence in 1980, you had, first of all, the new government, as it were, encouraging all Zimbabweans who were living abroad to return home with the skills which they had. And you had significant migration back into Zimbabwe. Between 1980 and 1983, almost all Zimbabweans who were overseas, either within the region or outside the continent, returned home. At the same time, you had a significant number of the sort of small, some would say white Zimbabwean community, or the descendants of the colonial settler population, who left the country mostly for South Africa, some going back to European countries and others going to Australia. During the first decade of Zimbabwe's independence, within the entire country, you had significant amounts, an upsurge almost, in rural-urban migration. And that was largely in response to the slow pace at which rural development was taking place immediately after independence. At the same time, there were far more employment and educational opportunities, not only already existing in the towns and cities, but growing rapidly in the towns and cities. The first decade of Zimbabwe's development, as independence, I suppose, was very much characterized by state policies that were urban biased. So significant amounts of resources went into developing the urban centers and the towns and the opportunities in them. And what that gave rise to was significant amounts of rural urban migration. And then coming into the 1990s, you had some reverse rural-urban migration. In the early 1990s, Zimbabwe had International Monetary Fund Program, or Structural Adjustment Program, or ESAP, as it is commonly known, Economic Structural Adjustment Program, which Zimbabweans like to call Extreme Suffering and Poverty. So their translation for ESAP is Extreme Suffering and Poverty. That particular program gave rise to a huge, huge increase in urban unemployment. So you had some reverse migration going, people going back to rural communities who'd lost their employment in urban centres, and then a speeding up, almost, as it were, of people leaving the country and looking for employment in countries within the region where the economies were a bit more dynamic, with the exclusion of South Africa, which didn't really come on stream until after 1994. Over the past decade, partly in response to, you know, heightening economic crisis, partly in response to, political tensions, and partly in response to the needs of economies like South Africa for particular types of skilled labour migrants, the needs of countries like Swaziland who have severe shortages of medical doctors. So partly in response to all of those factors, we've seen a significant increase in out-migration from Zimbabwe over the past decade. Now, while all of the attention has been focused on this out-migration from Zimbabwe, there has, in the past decade, also been some in-migration. So today, Zimbabwe is host to significant numbers of refugees, some from as far back as 1994-95, the Rwandan conflict or genocide, some from the conflict in Burundi, and in particular some coming from the Democratic Republic of the Congo and the war there, which only came to an end sort of in the early 2000s. So there has been some in-migration, but the out-migration certainly over the past decade has, you know, counteracted that considerably. The Zimbabwean population, which has migrated over the past decade or so, are a very heterogeneous group. They are men and women, children, family units. They come from very different socioeconomic backgrounds. They have very different levels of education. They have very different skills. And they have very different reasons for why they have migrated in the first instance. So it's almost impossible to categorize them other than to say that they have. You will find all of these traits in any Zimbabwean population that you come across as migrants. And the same applies to their position in their countries of destination. While some Zimbabwean migrants have done exceptionally well and have established themselves in their careers, with their families, established their homes, others have not been quite so fortunate. Many of them, in fact, have ended up in different parts of the world, underemployed, de-skilled because of underemployment, unable, perhaps, to fulfill, as it were, the aspirations they had when they were migrants. Nonetheless, as with many migrant populations, when you talk to them, irrespective of how they may appear to you from outside to be doing, they themselves see their migration as quite successful. The study which I was doing last year, there's been two studies really going on within this region. One is on issues of healthcare and migration, especially in the context of HIV and AIDS within the region, because we have some of the highest rates of HIV in this region globally. But this study from which, you know, I'm talking tonight was a piece of work which the International Organization of Migration wanted done. What they wanted to do was to compare the sort of socioeconomic situation of Zimbabweans in three SADC countries, where it was felt there was a sort of significant number of Zimbabwean migrants, Botswana, South Africa, and Swaziland. And there was a host of factors that we looked at, people's housing, their employment opportunities, why they had migrated in the first place, their age profile, and so on. But one of the very consistent issues which emerged in talking to around 506 in total in sort of nine different sites around the region was the attachments and links which people had with home. And while all of the people one was talking to had crossed borders in this region in one way or another, and some were documented and some were undocumented because it was a cross-section of migrants rather than any one category, all of them had retained very, very strong ties with home, very strong links with their families, their kinship groups, communities, and indeed even friends back home. And one of the ways in which those linkages emerged was, or sort of manifested themselves, was the significant amount of time and energy and effort and resources that went into sending remittances back home. And there's a tendency when we look at migrations, especially where a significant number of the people you're speaking to are or describe themselves as economic migrants or as labor migrants, there's a tendency to see remittances as the success of migration. In other words, the way in which successful migration manifests itself is that people are able to retain links with home and, you know, fulfill those linkages by sending back remittances. So I became quite interested in this issue of remittances and transfers between migrants and their home society, not just the remittances themselves, but also what appeared to me in simply interviewing people and talking to people to be a whole chain of transfers that were taking place between these populations. The remittances themselves were very, very significant in this particular study. I think something like 85% of all of those interviewed were sending some sort of remittances back home. And the 15% who were not were concentrated in two, they were clustered into two areas. One was Johannesburg, which is about here in South Africa, and the second area was just here on the Zimbabwean border in a town called Messina. And those two areas where this 15% were clustered had one other trait in common. They had the largest number of Zimbabweans who were homeless or not working at all, and the largest number who were in the country only for the past 2 or 3 weeks. So they hadn't, in fact, established themselves into a routine where they were earning resources which could be sent back home. So I suppose effectively you could say that for those who had been in their country of destination for any considerable period of time, they had started the remittance process to home. The regularity with which people sent remittances was really quite impressive. People were very clear. It was a very regular activity. Generally, people favored sending their remittances once per month, with smaller numbers of people saying they would do it every fortnight or every 3 months. Those who did it every 3 months, it was largely the feeling that it's better to build up more resources and send them. So rather than sending $200, you send $600. So it's a chunkier amount. But the majority, the vast majority, did it on a regular monthly basis. The remittances themselves were in the form of cash or sometimes in the form of goods, and usually a mixture of both, or it was quite flexible. In some instances it would be cash only, and then the next month it might be goods, or it might be cash and goods the following month. It wasn't, the remittances were constant, but the form and the content of those remittances were not. The manner in which remittances were sent was extremely interesting. I mean, there's essentially two ways in which you can remit your resources back home. You can do it formally through the banking institutions or through institutions such as Western Union, or you can do it informally. The formal channels are closed very often to people who are not documented within the system. The rules and regulations in most countries now, including countries like Botswana and South Africa, the rules and regulations around opening personal bank accounts make it very difficult for someone who's not well established in the system and certainly documented within the system to utilize those facilities. People also complain bitterly that far too much of the resources themselves are spent on the transfer in the first place. In other words, they complained that Western Union or the banks were simply charging them too much money. So the vast majority of people favored an informal method of transferring their resources. And those informal methods were very often family and friends who were going home. So they would know somebody who was going, or they would simply look for somebody who was going home at the end of each month or at the end of 3 months if they were doing a transfer on a three-monthly basis. Where they didn't find family and friends conveniently to take the resources for them, they utilized a host of other informal methods. Bus drivers, for example, would take money and deliver it on the other end for a commission. A fee. One of the things which was very interesting about the use of these informal channels was the amount of commission being paid, again, informally. People sometimes even having or admitting that they had to give relatives resources, some sort of commission, to take the money home for them. The same with bus drivers, who sometimes charge as much as 20% of the amount that is being remitted as the commission or as the fee for transferring it. So people complained very bitterly about the cost of this, but nonetheless carried on with that process. Those who were perhaps more skilled and in more formal types of employment used both. They used formal channels, they used informal channels. Those who were semi-skilled or skilled, but not necessarily employed in the profession they had trained for, or who were in more informal methods of employment, tended to favour, even if they were documented and had all of the necessary paperwork, they tended to favour informal methods and channels of transmitting their resources. And that, in fact, applied as well to a number of the highly skilled group. So while they would perhaps once or twice per year use a banking system, if given the opportunity to do this in an informal manner, people preferred to do it in an informal manner. And I think that was probably connected to the experiences Zimbabwean migrants had in sort of the period around 2005, 2006 with formal remittances. At one point, when the Zimbabwean diaspora was growing very rapidly in the sort of early to mid 2000s, a formal banking institution called Kumushi Akaya was set up by the Zimbabwean banks in Zimbabwe. And into that, you could remit money, and it would come out on the other end to your relatives. And it was particularly significant because during the time of hyperinflation, it was 2007 and 2008, when inflation could be 2,000 to 3,000% per day, the person receiving the remittances received them in a hard currency, in American dollars, British pounds, or euros. So they retained their value, even as the Zimbabwean dollar became, you know, worth less and less and less and less. Kumushi Akaya means simply to send it home in Shona. So that was simply a catchphrase used to send it. And that system worked very successfully for 2 to 3 years and then collapsed, basically. There was some very bad management by the state, by the Reserve Bank, and by some of the banks. So that the system collapsed, not in that it ceased to exist. It collapsed because one day they started issuing their remitters' money to people in Zimbabwean dollars as opposed to in the hard currencies that people have been getting used to. So effectively what people were remitting was now of less and less and less value because it was being hit by the hyperinflation of the period. And I think that's one of the reasons why even today the hangover of that now 5-6 years later is that people don't particularly trust the banking system. So even if they are paying more to remit money and goods informally, they will opt for that. One of the difficulties for those in low-paid occupations or those who are semi-skilled or perhaps not quite so skilled and earning quite low salaries or wages is that proportionately they are spending a far larger amount of their remittances and of their income on commission to transfer money home. And that's particularly acute for undocumented migrants who don't have the choice of using financial institutions or banking services to remit money. They have one option, and that is to send it informally. They are very often, because of their undocumented status, in very, very low-skilled, poorly paid occupations, but spending a very large amount of money of their income just trying to send remittances home. So they are the group that probably suffer most from not having open channels available to them. The remittances themselves, once they arrive, especially if they are in cash, there are 3-4 categories. You could categorize very easily what this money, these resources are spent on. The first one would be food and clothing for people at home. The second one would be the payment of school fees. The payment of school fees both for children within the extended family or kinship group, but also the payment of school fees for people's own children who continued to live in Zimbabwe though they had migrated to a country within the region. The third most common use of remittances was home improvements. In particular, migrants themselves improving their homes back home in Zimbabwe. And then the fourth very common use of remittances was the purchase of livestock and agricultural inputs like seeds and fertilizers for both relatives back home and for themselves if they had land, which perhaps a relative or somebody was farming for them while they were away as migrant workers. And that was consistent across all socioeconomic groups, all genders, and was very consistent irrespective of how long people had been in a country of destination. So it was not the case that initially people's remittances went on these categories and then changed after a specific period of time. It was a very regular and sort of consistent process. What then became evident is that the remittances are used for, they could be categorized, I suppose, one could say, into 2 main categories. They're used for either consumption or investment purposes. And the consumptive remittances are, of course, those used to buy food, to buy clothing. And they are very localized. They are transactions between individuals as migrants and their families back home. And some would argue that they have almost no impact on the local economy. In reality, the very fact that they are used for consumption purposes, they feed into the retail sector in the country where goods are bought, where clothes and shoes and food is bought, and they feed into the manufacturing sector, which produces those goods, because Zimbabwe did have, though it's not quite so strong at the moment, it had a very quite strong manufacturing sector. And they add a certain, though they, again, they are localized transfers of income and money between family members. They also add a certain liquidity to the economy. And this is an economy which has had serious liquidity problems over the last 2 to 3 years. Those that are used for investment purposes have much broader implications for the society. On the one hand, they provide, for example, educational fees at a point in time when the government is no longer able to provide free education, which was the case in Zimbabwe up until about 1998. So effectively, they're an investment in the future. They're an investment in the next generation and in the education of that generation. The same with remittances that are used for healthcare purposes for parents or aunts or uncles or indeed children. They're an investment in the health of the nation, I suppose one could say, or the health of the population. Those that are used for house improvements are, again, I suppose one could say, an investment in infrastructure. I mean, housing is part of the infrastructure of any one country. And a significant amount of the remittances were being used for either building housing stock for the individual themselves or improving housing back home for parents, brothers and sisters and so on and so forth. And of course, remittances that are used for agricultural purposes, whether it be to buy livestock or to buy seed and fertilizer, are feeding into the agricultural system, but they're adding to the food self-sufficiency of the country. And given that Zimbabwe is a very strong agricultural country, that's particularly important that the agricultural base start to operate again in a sort of more coherent way than has been the case for the last few years. So it's actually quite fair to say that both the consumptive and the investment type remittances both have a significant impact on what is happening within the country, and both of them add in some way to the sort of process of reconstruction in the country which is taking place at the moment. And for that reason, it's easy to perhaps walk away and say, well, one of the ways in which the success of the Zimbabwean diaspora manifests itself is through the transfer of remittances, and one of the ways in which the Zimbabwean diaspora is contributing to the country and to its reconstruction is, again, through the transfer of remittances. And even though the remittances themselves are very localized transfers within family and kinship groups, they do have a more national significance, even if we have no estimate as to how much is being remitted on any one day, any one week, any one month, or what the sort of statistics, as it were. So it would be easy to sort of leave it at that. But one of the things which interested me was once we talk of remittances, we are automatically saying, and I'm not, in any way saying that the remittances themselves are not important for all the reasons that I've pointed out, but there is a tendency to see remittances as a transfer from the migrant to the family back home, to parents, to children, and so on and so forth. So it's the migrant's success, basically, that they are in a position to establish themselves in another society and to be able to thereafter look after family back home. And there's a certain status, of course, for migrants. I mean, that is how migration and its success manifests itself. What that means is that power is sort of being almost transferred into some element of status, and power is being transferred to the migrant. And those back home are seen as simply the dependents, those who wait for the remittances to come, or those whose livelihoods and assets are dependent on this migration process. And of course, it is often the case that migration is not in any way an individual affair. It's a family decision that somebody will migrate who will then have the potential to look after other family members. But what interested me was to try to go beyond this emphasis on remittances and to look at a more complex range of transfers that were taking place between the migrants themselves and their kinship and family group members back home. And the types of transfers were sometimes quite intangible, and sometimes they were quite tangible. I mean, very often people had migrated because other members of their families had contributed the resources for them to move in the first instance. Right? There was one very young man in his sort of early 20s whom I met at that town near the border here in South Africa, in Messina, just here at the border, who had been robbed crossing the river, the Limpopo River, because the border between South Africa and Zimbabwe is, of course, the Limpopo. He had been robbed by what he described as Magumaguma. Magumaguma in the region is simply a term for thieves or robbers who wait in the bush and know that migrants are coming across and rob them. But he described not so much the loss of the money, which he felt he would ultimately get over once he found himself a job. He described how what pained him was that the money had been saved for him and given to him by his grandfather so that he could migrate. So it was his grandfather's money which he had lost. And of course, when I, you know, included this as part of the sort of questions to other migrants, quite large numbers of people had been dependent on their own relatives back home for moving. They had been given the resources in some way. Either they had been given monetary resources to pay for the bus fare, the train fare, the airfare if they were going to Europe. They had been given information very often that a relative had found from somebody they worked with in another town in Zimbabwe who had a relative working somewhere else who transmitted the information. They had very often been given very non-tangible things, like just the encouragement to migrate in the first instance. So clearly those at home were not only dependents, they were quite active participants in this particular migratory process. Many of those who had migrated within the region had left their children back home. They had not migrated as family units. And even where, you know, two partners had migrated, very often one partner went first, then had established themselves, the second one came. But the children remained at home. And the children were looked after by grandparents, by aunts, by uncles, by other siblings of the person who had migrated. And that was very significant for many migrants. It meant, first of all, that if they were undocumented in their destination country, they did not have the difficulty of their children being without education and healthcare. Two of the most difficult things for undocumented migrants to access in the region is healthcare and education. So by having them at home, looked after by relatives, they could ensure that they remained in the education system in Zimbabwe and that they had access to healthcare if they needed it. It also meant a certain flexibility for the migrants themselves. They could be more flexible in the type of hours they worked. They could be more flexible in both partners doing a nighttime shift because they didn't need somebody to be at home to look after the children. It meant a significant saving for many in terms of rent and accommodation because without having small children with them, they were more inclined to share accommodation with others, to use more cramped or perhaps smaller accommodation. So again, what you find is a transfer of resources where it's not a very tangible resource, but a transfer from those at home who are providing the facility for children to remain at home so that migrants are freer and more flexible to move within the region. It meant, of course, also that getting immigration status was sometimes much easier because you only had to think of yourself or you only had to think of yourself and perhaps your wife or your partner as opposed to also trying to get status for two or perhaps three children. The other thing that became sort of very obvious was the manner in which once people arrived in a country, the dependence they had as migrants on family members and indeed members of their own communities from home who were already established in that country. And those who were the only sort of two areas where people were homeless was clustered was in South Africa, in Johannesburg and in Messina. And those who were homeless, who were a minority certainly within the study, but those who were homeless had one very common characteristic. They either did not have any family, friends, or relatives in the country of destination, or they had arrived and been unable to find those family members. Right? In other words, the sorts of support structures which others had had when they arrived were not available to everybody. And the type of support structure in question is, of course, the situation when a migrant arrives, another family member or a friend or a, you know, a distant relative provides accommodation for them for the first few weeks, provides papers for them, tells them how to get documentation, tells them where to go, how to do it, takes them through the system, as it were, or introduces them to an employer and effectively finds accommodation, employment for them. And for the first 2 to 3 months, that was crucial. For those who consider themselves now established on their own, with their own place to stay, their own employment, their own resources, it was quite clear, the pattern that was there, that they'd had an inordinate amount of help and an inordinate amount of resources being transferred to them. Now, the resources, again, were not very tangible. The fact that they had someone's floor to sleep on for the first 3 months until they were able to find employment, or the fact that someone introduced them to a previous employer of theirs whom they knew was looking for some staff. And then that was became the first source of employment, and then, of course, they moved on at a later stage. When asked how they found employment, almost 90% of people used a personal contact to get employment. 10% used employment agencies, the newspapers, and again, they were kind of pretty much highly skilled sort of migrants. So there was quite a dependency on people at home and the resources they could provide to facilitate the migration process, and quite a dependency on those already established in destination countries, especially relatives or community members or members of kinship, wider kinship groups, who could sort of start the migrant off in the first instance. And I think the conclusion we can draw, I think I've gone way over my time here, the conclusion we can draw certainly as migration, students of migration, of migratory processes, is that yes, remittances are a key issue for migrants. And they are the way in which very often for both families and the migrants themselves, the success of migration manifests itself. But there is a danger if we stop at the sort of level of looking at remittances that we are artificially seeing the transfers in the migratory process as always between the migrant and those at home, where it is always the migrant who is transferring some sorts of resources, and therefore those at home are the dependents. In actual fact, this is a much more interactive process where both those at home, those who have left earlier, and the migrants themselves are involved in quite complex exchanges of tangible and non-tangible resources, only one of which is in fact remittances. I think I'll leave it there. I've gone way over the time I was given, so my apologies for that.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Mich interessieren würde in dieser Region, ich kenne sie nicht, gibt es dazu was wie ein Nationalbewusstsein, also eine nationale Identität? Oder bezieht man sich nur auf die Sippe, auf die Familie, auf Freunde?
This is Uli, by the way. She's asking, is there some feeling of national identity in that region, or is there more identification with ethnicity, with the ethnic group, you know?
What you have in all over the SADC region is a situation where a national identity was imposed on people. When the colonial borders were drawn up, what they did was to delineate territory between colonial powers as opposed to try to delineate population groups. And so what they did very often, these borders, was to cut right across. They didn't take into account the homogeneity of ethnic groups or the heterogeneity within particular territories. So very often the borders simply cut across ethnic groups. And so if you were to go to this border here between Zimbabwe and Botswana, the people on this side are Kalanga people, the people on this side are Kalanga people, which is an ethnic group. The same applies here on the South African-Zimbabwean border, the Zimbabwean border with Mozambique. What you have in this region, what you've had for all of the colonial period and indeed even today, is a dual sense of identity. the fact that the sort of national identity was imposed on people didn't mean that they didn't take on board that modern, so-called modern national identity. But what they did was to also keep a very strong sense of localized ethnic identity. So what you have is both, basically. And people are quite nationalistic, and let's face it, the liberation movements in that region were all focused on the liberation of the nation state. They were quite nationally focused. And the sort of glue that solidified those movements very often was the single goal of an independent nation state. But the populations, and the populations were encouraged in the colonial period to keep a dual sense of identity. I mean, they had dual legal systems, dual political systems, one for the European population, one for the local African population. And then in the post-independence era, what most governments have done is to simply incorporate that into the new state, as it were. So they've not in any way tried to ban, as it were, the idea of local ethnicities. There is a very strong emphasis in the region on national identity and on all the symbols of national identity. But there is also a very strong acceptance that there are very local ethnic identities as well that are quite strong.
If you ask, for example, in the project in England, if you ask a family, you know, about their feeling of identity, you know, outside of the fact that they might identify with Britain at that stage, they would always have a national identity in terms of, let's say, I'm Zimbabwean, I'm Ethiopian, but they would additionally identify with an ethnic group, like I'm a Shona or whatever. Mm. So that's how it came across to me with the study in England.
And Zimbabwe has three ethnic groups, the Shona, who are the largest, the Indibele, who are themselves a colonial settler population from pre-European colonial times, and who are very close in language and in culture to the Zulu people in South Africa, and then the Tonga, a very small group of people in the north of the country, who again are divided between the Zimbabwean and Zambian side of the border. And in fact, when Lake Kariba was built, which is the largest man-made lake in Africa in Zimbabwe, and also a hydroelectric power station, Tonga people were moved by the so-called Southern Rhodesian government at the time across the border into Zambia. So they changed nationality quite sort of readily. It also means that within that region there's a lot of movement that does not in any way take into account borders. And so a common phrase from people in the region would be, but my uncle's house is just 5 minutes over there, can't you see it? Why would I go 10 kilometers to the border post and come 10 kilometers back to see my uncle and then make the same trip again? I can just walk across. So I mean, these borders are notoriously porous and arbitrary. So I think most people, what Petra says is quite true. They would have, certainly in the region, I didn't have the sense that the majority of Zimbabwean migrants were seeing themselves, perhaps because it's early days yet for them, but that they were in any way identifying themselves with their host country. So I didn't find people saying, I'm South African or I'm Botswana. Right, they only did that when they didn't want the local population to know they were migrants. So if it's a Zimbabwean who has been in Botswana for the past 8 years and is now fluent in the Tswana language and is therefore almost indistinguishable from the Tswana population themselves, or a Kalanga person from the Zimbabwean side of the border in Francistown, which is an area predominantly of the Kalanga population, And therefore the language is the same and the accent, of course, will change over time. When they wanted to pass as local, they would say, yes, I'm a Zimbabwean. And only if you then said, no, I know I'm a Botswana. Only if you said, look, I know you're not a Botswana. Let's, get down to basics here. Would they identify with the host society or the country they had migrated to? So they tended to either describe themselves as Zimbabwean or to describe themselves as Shona, Tonga, Indibele. The Indibele population that had migrated to South Africa, they were more inclined to describe themselves as South African and to have seen themselves, we've come home, as it were, to where the bigger group that we are part of, the Zulu population, exists. They also found it much easier to pass within the system. And they noted that it was, if you spoke the language, so you spoke Zulu because you speak Sintabele, you had considerably easier time in finding employment. You didn't have linguistic barriers, in other words, or sort of other barriers there.
Could I just ask, what about the second generation? Like, are you talking about like the first generation?
These are first generation.
Because I found comparatively in this study about Africans in Britain that the second generation had a lot more identification than with the country of migration, of immigration, whereas the first generation always had the group identification, ethnic group or country of origin. Yes.
Thank you very much for that very interesting presentation. Let me ask my question in German to enforce the discussion a little bit. Sorry, Petra.
No problem.
Ich habe drei Fragen. Die eine Frage ist, ändert sich durch die Migration der Status im Herkunftsland? Also ist es ein Punkt, mit dem man im Herkunftsland aufsteigen kann von der gesellschaftlichen Position her?
Does migration change the status in the country of origin in terms of upward mobility? If they migrate.
When they return, if they come back.
Also wenn sie, yeah.
If they return.
When they do return.
Ah. That is a very, very good question, because that was one of the main recommendations that came from this report. It seemed that there was going to be, that if this migrant population were to leave South Africa, leave Botswana, Malawi or wherever, and go back home, that they could not be reincorporated into the system back home. For a number of reasons. Either the posts were not, the jobs were not there, because the economy is only slowly beginning to grow again. Or those who were at home were sort of almost closing the system. In other words, there was a tension emerging between those who hadn't migrated, especially those in the skilled sector. There was a certain tension emerging between those who stayed throughout the crisis and those who had left. So that those who now had left, gone and worked abroad as migrants and were now going back, found it quite difficult to network themselves back into the system. There were questions over how those who had been de-skilled and had not been able to work in certain professions as migrants, how they were going to fit back into the system. So somebody is, let's say, a teacher. Because one of the things that emerged is that the majority, almost all of the people in this study, had been very active in the labour market in Zimbabwe before they left. They were not unemployed people who had left. And they were now active in the labour market in another country. But they were not necessarily active in the same way. So very often you found people working on commercial farms in South Africa, picking grapes, this seasonal agricultural labour, which pays quite well because it pays on a daily basis, would have been teachers or nurses in Zimbabwe. When they went home, and there were a number of examples of this, they went back, by not describing what they had been doing, implicitly, people at home thought they had been teaching in South Africa, and then discovered that these people had been out of teaching for maybe 8 to 10 years, and were now quite de-skilled. So what has happened within Zimbabwe itself is that the professions in particular, nursing, medicine, teaching, banking and accountancy, these ones in particular, have encouraged the government to set up a process now where they can in fact check, have people been working and using their skills while they have been abroad. And it's not only for those within the region, the same is happening with those coming back from the UK, coming back from Germany, coming back from Russia, wherever they have actually been. So there are a number of issues there. First of all, what will happen to those who have been de-skilled while they were overseas? How do you differentiate those who have been de-skilled? Because those who have not been able to work in their professions as migrants are very insulted when they're asked to prove that they have been working as a teacher in South Africa, because they have not often told either family or friends what they've really been doing there. So there's that issue. There is a very significant issue for those who left without having acquired who were working in Zimbabwe but left before they had acquired a formal qualification. And so one of the things I found with this study is an over-representation of people who had completed what was called Form 4 or O-level in Zimbabwe. O-level is effectively the end of high school or secondary school. Now, one of the reasons so many people had completed O-level is that the government education policy from 1980 to 1998 had been that everyone would have free education up to the end of high school. Right? But O-level is an academic qualification. It does not give you a skill. So unlike a nurse who now has an additional skill, or an electrician or a plumber who has an additional skill, people who left with O-level, and there were significant numbers of them, and have been working in unskilled employment, say in South Africa or Botswana, they are not going back with a skill. So on the one hand, you have the de-skilled, the skilled who have become de-skilled. How do you absorb them back into the system? Now, one of the things to do is, of course, to have retraining programs. Those who left with education, academic education, but without a skill, who haven't acquired skills and haven't been able to put themselves into a skilling process in South Africa and in another country, what do you do when they return? Because effectively they don't have skills to slot back into the labor market. And then you have the, as I said, the more intangible resistance by people at home to people coming back from outside. And in fact, it was only because I went to Harare at one stage to look at some of those who had come back that this issue arose of routes being blocked to people and considerable tensions between those who had remained behind and those who had left. And some of it was connected to the manner in which people left. In some ways, one could say that the migrants were almost their own worst enemies. So one senior doctor in a hospital described how, over a period of, say, 18 months, he would have, you know, his colleagues on a Friday afternoon, and the roster would be there for the weekend, and he would have his first weekend off in 6 weeks. And then on Saturday morning, he would get a phone call to say that five of those people hadn't shown up for work. So he would, or two of them. So he would have to go into the hospital, only to discover by the Monday, so now he's lost his weekend. And then he discovers by the Monday, because he's quite senior, so he has to establish where his staff are, that they've left the country without telling anybody, without notifying anyone. And this was happening quite a lot in the period of 2007 and 2008. Quite a lot of skilled Zimbabweans left in what would be described, I think, as quite a reckless manner. Because at the time there was a momentum about out-migration. There was no stigma and no difficulty in going to your head of surgery, or if you're a medic, or your head of school if you're a teacher, and saying, look, I can't support my family any longer. I have to go, right? Because they themselves had brothers and sisters and were thinking of going themselves. So what happened in many of the professions was, I think, a sense of letdown and a sense of almost disgust in those who had remained behind holding the baby, as it were, as people just left without notifying anyone. And now suddenly the things are beginning to improve and have improved considerably over the last 18 months. Those ones are watching people coming back, and not only coming back expecting to go slot themselves back into the same post in the hospital or in the school, but coming back saying, well, I have an extra 6 years experience now in Germany, where they have better technology, or in England or in South Africa, so therefore I should be more senior than you. So there are a lot of tensions, and it's not clear what will in fact happen, or what would happen today, if very large numbers of Zimbabweans, both skilled and unskilled or de-skilled, were to return home. One of the things which was recommended in this report was that the group who had an academic training but who did not have any specific skills training, that specific targeted programs be set up, and that seeing as there is a shortage of skilled labor in Zimbabwe at the moment, people be encouraged back into those programs and then into employment, and that the professions be also encouraged to resolve these tensions within themselves.
It relates also a bit to the brain gain, brain drain, brain circulation theory, doesn't it?
It does.
How this circulating with knowledge and knowledge going back.
Yes,
and,
yes, it does. Yeah. And to the barriers. I mean, in some ways what you're seeing there are barriers to people going back. And one of the things which I thought was quite discouraging in Harare was looking at 10 or 12 people in their late 20s, early 30s who have now returned to Zimbabwe. They're quite skilled, quite well educated. They had been quite skilled before they left. They had gone to the States in some case, to the UK, two of them to Germany because they had already studied in Germany in the 80s and were fluent in German. So they found it easier to go to Germany, in fact, perhaps, than anywhere else. Looking at 12 of them, whom I sort of followed around for a couple of weeks, none of them had been employed back into the local labor market. They had found employment either in a relative's company, in the case of those who did business and finance, or they had tried to establish and become self-employed, establish business of their own, or they had found employment, were deeply dissatisfied, and were planning to leave again. So there is an issue there as to whether there will be any circular movement of this sort of brain drain. Some of those who remained in Zimbabwe and didn't leave, those in the professions, argue now quite strongly that the best way to deal with the shortage of skills in certain areas is to forget about the diaspora and to start building from within. In other words, to almost step back to where we were in 1980. And we had, and remember, Zimbabwe is only 30 years independent. It's a relatively young state. And many of the programs we're talking about of trying to upskill people quickly to get them into the, existed there. They were set up. There was a program, for example, called ZimTech from 1981 until 1989, which was an expedited way of training teachers. So instead of taking 3 years, which was the normal length for teacher training, there was a compressed course for 18 months. And that produced significant numbers of teachers into the system. Just 6 to 8 months, I think, ago, they have set up a similar type of expedited training for nurses. And there I've seen a number of Zimbabwean women in Botswana who have an O-level qualification. They have the academic qualification, but not the skills, going home into this nurse training program. Actually, no, I'm wrong there. It's not 6 months. It's about 18 months because the first group are almost finishing. Some of the women I know on the first group intake are almost finishing. So there is a history in Zimbabwe of expediting the creation of skills. And I think what many people in Zimbabwe today argue is that let's go into an expediting process and stop looking towards the diaspora to come back with their skills because, A, they may not come, they may not stay, and they might simply be more trouble than we anticipate. But that is also driven by some of this tension between those who stay and those who go.
Ja, meine zweite Frage bezieht sich auf die Familienstrukturen. Mir scheint eine ähnliche Situation gegeben zu sein wie zwischen Ost- und Westeuropa und auch manchen Ländern Lateinamerikas und den USA. Und in beiden Fällen, bei Ost- und Westeuropa und bei Lateinamerika und USA, ist festgestellt worden, dass sich in den Sendeländern die Familienstrukturen ganz stark verändern. Die Arbeitsteilung ändert sich und das Ansehen der Familie ändert sich. Ist das hier auch der Fall?
The question really is about family structure and the status or the way the society or the public would look at the families in the case of migration. And there is reports, or it's been reported, that between Eastern and Western European migrant movements, as well as Latin America and the USA, if a case of migration, the status and the family structure changes, and that changes the status of the family in the public eye. Would that be also the case with migration patterns in the SADC region and around Zimbabwe, etc.?
I think what you find is there is no difficulty when children are separated from parents and remain in the country of origin with their grandparents. Because they're, you know, Zimbabweans subscribe to an extended family system, it's quite acceptable that parents might move for financial reasons or employment reasons without the children. So it would be simply seen as the service provided by the extended family to maintain the children. There is a great deal of skepticism about how then this nuclear family, which goes into
social migration process is going to survive, right? And remember again that it's only 30 years since Zimbabweans experienced significant amounts of out-migration. So they lived all the way through the 1960s and 70s. Families in Zimbabwe lived with large numbers of relatives overseas. And they themselves, as returning migrants, also knew that many families had simply disintegrated. So people had married, very often met overseas, married. Some people had left children in Europe when they returned home because the marriages had split up. So I think at the moment, there isn't any sense, people don't have a sense that because people leave children behind to be looked after by the extended family or by other relatives, that that is in any way problematic or that that is in any way a symptom of any kind of changing family structure. And equally, where wives stay at home, because there were significant numbers of men, especially in South Africa, working on the farms, working in commercial farms as farm laborers, either on a seasonal agricultural basis or more permanently, where their wives stayed in Zimbabwe with the children because it's very close. They can commute quite quickly between these areas. There wasn't necessarily any huge sense among people that this was problematic. There was a very strong sense that the younger migrants would never settle down or that they would have problems establishing any kind of family structure. There was a great deal of concern expressed by middle-aged and older migrants that the younger migrants were not behaving as they should towards their families. And when they said behaving as they should, there were complaints. The younger ones don't send the remittances. They are forgetting about the family back home. They are drinking too much. They are only here to enjoy themselves. They are not settling down. So certainly there were some tensions emerging there. One of the things that I suppose was evident was that certainly family life had been disrupted for large numbers of people. But there were certain types of employment that lent themselves to the disruption of family life more than others. And sometimes the disruption was the nature of the employment. So women working as domestic workers in someone's house were provided with accommodation, but were expressly prevented and prohibited from having their husband or partner with them or their children. So even if their spouse or partner was living in the same city, they couldn't live with their wife, right? So that type of work by women was seen as very disruptive of their family life. And women in particular are concerned as to what their husbands were doing when, you know, they were staying elsewhere or whatever. Those who worked on commercial farms had an economic reason. They were not prohibited from having their families with them, but they had to pay additional rent each month. They stayed on the farm, in a compound of houses. And then if you had your wife, and they were predominantly male migrants, if you had your wife and your children with you, you paid X amount per month. So it was cheaper to have them at home. That was seen as less disruptive because a lot of that agricultural migration, labor migration, is seasonal. It's for 3-4 months at a time. Plus there is a history of that type of migration, even where it's more long-term. There's a history between South Africa and Zimbabwe of people migrating and going back once a year, right? Only one person in all of the work had a polygamous marriage. He had a wife in South Africa and a wife in Zimbabwe and intended to have both wives. But I think perhaps the other thing which mediates against a very strong sense in people of family structures changing is polygamy itself. And even, you know, prior to Zimbabwe's independence, when you had large amounts of rural to urban migration in the colonial era, where labor was recruited to service the mines and the sort of emerging cities, you had very often what were called, you had marriages at home in the village. And then when a man migrated, because all of the initial colonial labor migration was male migration, more or less, you had people establishing what we commonly call in Zimbabwe mapots. marriages. M-A-P-O-T-S. Pots, as in pots for cooking. And what a pots marriage meant was that a man was in town as a migrant laborer. He had no one to cook for him. So he took a second wife in a, not necessarily a formal way. Some of those marriages, some of those relations became formal marriages, and the men were polygamous thereafter. Some of it was in quite an informal way, that he had someone he lived with in town, common law union, if you want to call it that. But that didn't mean that he didn't send resources home to his wife and children, and that each year at the annual holiday when the company he worked for closed down or the mine closed down, he didn't return home to the village. So I think, you know, that their family structures and forms have been changing a lot, have changed a lot before in that region because of migration. And so people don't perhaps focus on it quite so strongly.
Dann die letzte Frage ist nochmal ganz kurz. Es gibt in allen Studien den Nachweis, dass die Zahlungen, die die Migrantinnen nach Hause leisten, um einiges höher sind als die der Männer, obwohl die Männer weitaus mehr verdienen in der Migration. Frage, ist das da auch so?
Okay, studies say that the remittances that are sent by back home by women are higher than the ones sent back by males, even though the males have actually a higher income as migrants in general than the women. The question is that the same way in your experience, your study, the region?
Not in this particular study. I agree with you that yes, very often women do send a larger portion of their income as remittances. Though their income may be lower than that of men as migrants, they send a bigger portion. I think here, first of all, more of the women were in low-paid jobs, and a higher number of the men were in skilled employment. So men had more disposable income. Remember, this is a relatively new migrant community as well, so the sort of tiredness that people get of sending remittances hadn't set in. I think it's possible that as a percentage of income, women were sending more. But the actual amount being remitted, the physical amount, so as a percentage, women might send 40%, men might send 30%, but 30% of 1,000 is bigger than 40% of 300. But certainly in Ireland, one of the things we've seen in the past decade, we recruited, prior to our current dilemmas, we had, during what is famously known as the Celtic Tiger, this period of economic growth came to a sad end, we had recruited significant numbers of Filipino nurses into the health system, many of whom are still in Ireland. And one of the things that was very noticeable, because they are almost all women, there was a small number of men from the Philippines as nurses who came, but they were predominantly women. And one of the things that was very evident is their spouses and children remained in the Philippines, and they were remitting sometimes up to 60-70% of their income. Right? And interestingly, or sadly, about a week and a half ago, one of the Filipino nurses, we had floods in Dublin, freak floods for a day when the entire city was underwater almost. And one of the people who drowned was a Filipino nurse. And in describing her circumstances, they described how she had been in Ireland for 10 years working as a nurse, and described the hospital she'd been in, and how her husband and son had always lived in the Philippines, and she was using the money she was earning in Ireland to put her son through medical school in the Philippines. And he was just about to finish medical school, so now she had begun to talk to people at work recently about going back home, because presumably he would now take up the sort of... And also you have situations like the Philippines, where they have produced, and this is why sometimes we get this preponderance of women as migrants sending remittances home. You get two types of situations. Countries such as the Philippines, who overtrain the number of nurses. In other words, they deliberately train significant numbers of nurses to send them as migrants, right? Knowing that remittances will come back. In other words, they're factoring those remittances into their training programs, into the cost of training and education, and into the national budget as return income. And then you have some of the Latin American countries and some of the countries like Bangladesh, where families make the decision. So of course then nurses, say from the Philippines, will go on their own. There's a history, a tradition to this. It's not seen as in any way problematic for families. Then you have other societies such as Bangladesh, where families decide that it's more valuable to send a woman, even if she is unskilled, to work in Italy or in Germany or wherever as a nanny or as a domestic worker for a family, because a woman will find employment more readily. In other words, where labor markets are thought to be difficult to penetrate by unskilled migrants, families will sometimes decide, but women can penetrate the market in Dubai or the market in Italy as nannies for children or as domestic workers in homes. So therefore they are more likely to find employment and then, you know, concentrate on sending a woman. And then again, that person, because they have been sent, feels obliged, but also knows that they have been sent to send resources back home. So I think sometimes it's very dependent on why people come and how the decision is made. And you do have cases of where women are forced into labor migration by their families so that they can become the remittance providers because some work is available that they can engage in.
Is it also more likely that women are getting back and moving backwards home than men if they're migrating?
I don't think so. I think, you know, when and why and how migrants decide to move back home is probably as complicated for women as it is for men. There are factors that sometimes make it more likely that women don't move, and one of them is if they have a husband or a partner with them, very often they will not move back home until the man moves, right? If they are women who, as in the case of the Filipino nurses we've just been talking about, who have come to Ireland or to Italy or wherever to work as nurses, then they will do a specified period of time. And when they've achieved the aim for which they came, they're more likely to move back home. But I think for both men and women, the factors that affect them returning home are probably equally similar, equally complicated. I don't know what you think, Petra, but I don't see any evidence to suggest that one group is more likely to migrate back than others. Except perhaps women who are trafficked and forced into, you know, whether it's the sex industry or some other type of illegal activity. Obviously, if they are rescued or given the opportunity, they are quite likely to say, yes, I want to go back. I you know, didn't know I was coming into this type of scenario in the first place.
I want to ask you a question about your about Ireland, your personal background. When I came to Ireland first time, I was in an exchange student program, and I was with a host family who just came back from Rhodesia, mm-hmm. and I experienced many Irish people coming back. Mm-hmm. So probably it's no coincidence that you as an Irish person are researching in migration. Is the situation in Ireland comparable? Is there a comparison or a difference between Western style of re-migration and the countries you are referring about?
You mean, is there a similarity in the types of movements?
Yeah, I mean, both Ireland was very rural, and mm-hmm. they have huge families.
Yes. I mean, if you break Irish emigration down into decades or perhaps longer periods of time, because it's been happening since the 1870s. You do see some similar trends. I mean, if you go to the United States, for example, you have entire areas that are predominantly Irish. You have extensive networks of families, of people with friends, of people with relatives, people from the same village, all going to the same part of the States. So, you know, someone's likely to go to Boston because everybody from the local town has always gone to Boston, or because their parents knew somebody who was in Boston. So certainly in terms of, you know, this use of networks, this resource that networks are, the same information comes back in the exact same way. It comes back from people who have already migrated back to people at home, information about jobs being available. All of these rather intangible, I suppose, resource transfers, having someone to stay with when you first go to America for an Irish person was a key issue. Somebody accommodated you for the first couple of months, found you some sort of employment. So certainly there you do see similarities. The remittances, I mean, I remember growing up in Ireland at a point in time, and I think it's only very recently that this isn't happening, up until relatively recently, when you looked at the government budget each year, you know, when they did the budget in December, and you look at all the different categories of income and expenditure in the government budget, at the end of the sheets of paper that you get was a line that said remittances. And that was there as late as 1996-97. Now, I haven't had an opportunity to check whether it's disappeared during the Celtic Tiger and has resurfaced. And I remember a time when people on the west coast of Ireland, which is the closest to New York, in the 60s in particular, children on the west coast were distinctively dressed because they were wearing American clothes, right? So food parcels came and clothing parcels as late as the 1970s back to people. And then, of course, the other similarity is the undocumented migrants. I mean, we estimate 150,000 undocumented, illegal Irish immigrants in America. And that is a way underestimated.
Isn't it about 40 million people of Irish descent globally around the world outside of Ireland, 4 million Irish in the Republic of Ireland?
Around the place. I think in terms of closeness to being Irish, it's probably closer. There's 4 million outside, 4 million inside, but I've heard this figure of 40 million around. But the numbers of Irish people who are undocumented and illegal in countries like the States, and who were not only from the past, but even during this economic boom of the Celtic Tiger, were still there. And so Ireland has a very strong pressure group at the moment. Almost every American president who comes to visit Ireland and claims Irish roots, and we seem to be able to attract all of them, the first thing on the agenda when they arrive is the Irish government asking that some amnesty be introduced to allow those who are illegally in America to regularize their stay. And the situation of some of those illegal Irish immigrants in the States is as sad as the situation of many of these undocumented migrants. They don't get home when their parents die, because once they leave, they can't get back into America. They work in unskilled, poorly paid systems. They very often lose touch sometimes with family and friends back home. So yes, there are similarities. And at the moment, one of the things I find, because I'm now in Ireland for a year on sabbatical, is not only the shift from the in-migration of the past 10 years into Ireland and the significant numbers of people coming into the country, both as labour migrants and as refugees and asylum seekers, but that suddenly, and so migration was redefined in Ireland from about 1996. Migration in Ireland up until 1996 always meant emigration. It meant, when you used the word migration, you meant the Irish diaspora. And then we had a change where migration meant in-migration and some out-migration, but the balance was shifting. And now we have swung again. Migration now, when you say the word migration today in Ireland, people simply assume you're talking of the new diaspora, because we have significant, very high rates of emigration. Though we still have some immigration coming into the country, especially at the level of refugees and asylum seekers. So in answer to your question, yes, you do see similarities, yes.
Could I just, are there any more questions? Because otherwise I'll close off with my final question from the audience. Any more questions? Then I'll just ask you one last final question. You know, Castles and Miller, for example, argue that the remittances contribute to a certain percentage of several GDPs, global world GDPs. Like, as far as I remember, India, Pakistan have a very high percentage of their GDP financed by remittances. Would you know any figures about some of the Southern African countries, or maybe Ireland, if there are any, because the accuracy of these figures is not always very, very good?
To be honest, in Southern Africa, we have no sense of how much.
There's no statistics. Yeah.
Well, that's not strictly correct. Where in the past there were state-structured agreements between countries, you do know. So, for example, during the apartheid era in South Africa, when migrant labor was recruited for the mines or other sectors by the South African government from Mozambique, Swaziland, and Lesotho, who were two of the main migrant areas, the agreements signed between the Mozambican government, the Swazi government, the Lesotho government, and South Africa involved the transfer of a certain portion of remittances. So in other words, when people were employed from Swaziland in South Africa in a mine, the agreement with the Swazi government and the South African apartheid government was that 30% of each migrant's income would be remitted to Swaziland each year. So where you had state-structured systems like that, you did have quite accurate figures. And at one point, it was thought that 55% of Mozambique's budget was coming from remittances, which was very, very high. In Swaziland, it would have even been higher, because the amount of migration from Swaziland, both in the past and today, into South Africa, is very significant. But now that we've entered an era where migration is not done in a state structured, in these state structured agreements, but it's more an individual affair. It's more the individual migrant moving. And there are none of those agreements within the region. We have really no way of trying to track. And especially if most remittances are going back home informally, we have even less opportunities to track them. I mean, when we had the, what we call Kamusha Kaya in Zimbabwe, it was quite possible to go to each bank and ask, and for the government to ask each month how much has come back from Germany, from England, just in total. Since that ended, there is actually no way of knowing. From what I saw on these borders and just talking to the migrants themselves, I would say significant amounts of resources are being transferred, more so than governments think, and of more substantial contribution to the societies and the economies than what the governments. And in fact, there's a need in this region for governments to acknowledge that remittances do exist and that they are important and significant, because there's a tendency for governments in this region to attach some sort of stigma to remittances, you know, to see that, well, if 10% of our budget is dependent on remittances, that's not such a positive thing. In actual fact, it can be seen as a positive thing. And if you don't, one of the things that strikes me is if you don't acknowledge the importance of these remittances, you're isolating yourself and you're alienating your diaspora and your migrants even further.
Okay, thank you very much. I would like to finish off by thanking the audience for attending. I think it was a very, very interesting talk. Thank you to the Kepler Saloon for all the support and giving us the opportunity. And, yes, of course, most important, thank you, Tressa, for coming and giving this informative piece of talk. Thank you.
Thank you all very much.